Like, give me a 90s erotic thriller any day of the week.
Yeah, any of those Poison Ivy ripoffs.
Mm-hmm. Crush all of them. Fear, I'm in.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. I am Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California. Regular co-host Keith Foster is not here with me today, but with me we have another special guest, filmmaker and horror enthusiast Sam Weinman here from Los Angeles as well, right?
Hello, yes, that's me.
Now, I said right because you travel a lot. I follow you on Facebook, and it seems about every 6 months you're living somewhere else.
Yeah, that's 100% true.
And I was a little concerned at first about us doing this so late, because I'm like, wait, is he East Coast now? Because that would put him out like 1 o'clock.
No, I was just in New York for about a week. Yeah, okay. But I'm back. Yeah. Cool. I do travel as much as possible. I also tend to live in the Bay in the summertime, because that's where I teach a class. So.
Right, right. I forgot about that whole thing. Yeah, you teach a horror horror course there, don't you, or have?
Well, yeah, actually, right now it's a film production course, but in the past I have taught a course on slasher films, right. Which, of course, is my jam.
Yes, which is why I had you on to talk about Happy Death Day. And the Netflix homework that you assigned me, I asked you, you know, via Facebook what you wanted to talk about, and there's a new film by Mick G that was just uploaded direct to Netflix called The Babysitter.
Yes.
And at first I thought, like, the Alicia Silverstone thing from 1995, but...
No, also that's fantastic, but this is a little bit of higher quality.
Right, I'm all about the pre-Clueless Alicia Silverstone thrillers.
Listen, that's a super weird movie, and I'm into that too. Like, give me a 90s erotic thriller any day of the week.
Yeah, any of those Poison Ivy ripoffs.
Mm-hmm, crush all of them. Fear, I'm in.
Now, you're kind of a big deal. You're selling yourself
false.
Short. I sort of false. Discovered you, first of all. I discovered you through a very popular podcast that we're both fans of called Throwing Shade.
Yes, Throwing Shade.
About 3 or so years ago, they gave you a shout out on a YouTube series you were doing called Date Trip, which is like a docuseries. Which I thought was fantastic. I thought it was a really, really interesting concept. I thought that it was shot really well. I thought that the way you edited it, and, you know, your sense of storytelling, even within reality footage, was really strong. And then it just so happened that, like, a year later, we ended up going to school together, but we never actually saw each other.
Very true. Cassie, I totally forgot that you found me through Date Trip.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, Date Trip was a huge part of my path to filmmaking, mm-hmm. because it was the first project that I had actually directed. Everything before that I had just written and, of course, fantasized forever about making films. Right. But I hadn't taken that leap until then, and what a wonderful leap it was.
Yes, it was. And what I liked about Date Trip, and we'll get into your horror stuff, of course, but what I liked about Date Trip was that it made me very nostalgic for, like, the early 2000s MTV-style docudramas. Like, the
yes.
real-life stuff and, like... And that was very much sort of the aesthetic that I got from it.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because for me growing up, the only place that I saw queer identified characters was that MTV reality doc stuff.
Sure.
And so really that's where I kind of based my concept of what it is to be gay from, mm-hmm. just because that was all that was available. So those had a huge impact on me. And it's funny because actually when we were talking about Date Trip, I used an MTV style reality docs as a reference mm-hmm. for what it is that we were creating. So it's, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's it's an aesthetic that definitely impacted me.
Mm-hmm. I think True Life, I'm Coming Out was like incredibly impactful for me. That was like 2002 or something. There was nothing like that on TV at the time.
Yeah. And for me, even deeper, like The Real World, just the, you know, way back when they only had, you know, they'd have like a gay character. And,
mm-hmm.
and that was just how I would, you know, I would stay up late at night, like when my parents, there was no chance that they could hear me staying up watching this. I was afraid they'd find out, you know?
Right.
And,
right.
Like, that would be their immediate response. And, you know, I just would watch it in secret, but I would just revel in it. Mm. And now it's funny because it's almost full circle. Now I don't create any content that doesn't have queer identified characters in it.
Yes. And I wanted to get into that. You are a huge advocate, not only for horror film in general, but for queer themed horror.
Absolutely.
Which I guess some would think is sort of a niche, but not really. If you actually look over the history of horror film all the way back from James Whale in the Universal films, up through now, it's always queer directors, queer writers, and themes have always been a big part of the genre.
Absolutely. But it's always been a part of the genre. Well, it's often been a part of the genre as the monster, you know?
Yes, that's true.
And the big bad.
Yes, exactly. And actually, I kind of wanted to ask you about that as well. You know, where do you, how do you reckon, I suppose, with the fact that, like, movies like Sleepaway Camp and Cruising, Basic Instinct kind of, but not really, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, all of these films which deal in queer content but was sort of othering it, has now been sort of appropriated or sort of taken back into the culture as ironic celebration?
I love that we can reclaim things and make them ours. I love that we can do that even with the Babadook. You know, it's like,
right, yeah.
That's not, the fact of the matter is something like Sleepaway Camp really isn't. You know, if you look at it, there's so much more that needs to happen. I personally love Sleepaway Camp too, where mm-hmm. I feel like we know who she is. She is a trans woman mm-hmm. and she is fulfilling. It's like a wish fulfillment path where she just picks off all of these horrible people one at a time. but you know, I think there are examples of queerness in film that aren't repulsive,
mm-hmm.
but I can't think of examples that are just like, yes, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to see all the time. You know, I think that they did the best they could at a time when maybe it wasn't so acceptable. Or, you know, maybe it wasn't even on purpose, and then we've gone ahead and taken it and made it ours. You know,
sure.
Like, you know.
Well, one of the great things about genre films in general, including and in maybe even mostly horror, is that you're dealing almost exclusively in metaphor, especially when it comes to things like supernatural horror. So in that way, these directors, these writers, these actors were able to sort of delve into the personal in a more broad, mainstream way. And things slipped in there, all sorts of different social mores and taboos, slipped in there in, interesting ways and was able to converse with the audience over time.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at anything that, Kevin Williams has written, for example, like if we're looking at, you know, Scream with the mm-hmm. killers and kind of the subtext there, or, Don Mancini, who did all the Chucky films.
Sure.
You know, there are examples of subtext and ultimately in that series, especially where it actually comes to the surface. But they're, you know, allegory, metaphor, play really hard into the characters and their journeys. And so I think it's there on purpose because there are so many, queer identified writers, directors, mm-hmm. and people who haven't had a chance to put in there. But there are also moments that we can just take and make them ours because we identify, like, say, The Hitcher, you know, like that. Have you seen The Hitcher?
You know what? That's on my list of shame. No, I know of it. Rutger Hauer. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a film which has a huge queer following because it came out at a time when, you know, the word AIDS wasn't even printed in the New York Times yet, you know, mm-hmm. and it follows kind of a path where once this guy is touched by the hitcher who grabs his thigh in a very sexual moment and hitchhiking, which has a history that's well embedded in the gay community, especially at that time. Mm-hmm. Everybody that he interacts with after that dies. And so, whether that movie was directly commenting on that or purposefully queer, it had a response from a queer audience who looked at those themes, identified with those themes, and recognized it for what was going on with them at the time. So, you know, I see merit in both.
And then you have something like, you know, I guess prestige horror, stuff like Silence of the Lambs, which is such a difficult movie to kind of deal with social politically, because on one hand, it is like one of the most overt feminist movies ever made. But then on the other hand, you have the Buffalo Bill character, which I love that performance because he's so committed to it. But at the same time, it's problematic nowadays. I don't know. How do you reckon with that?
That's such a tough question, because it's difficult when we are starved for quality material. Mm-hmm. I know I personally will take whatever I can get and be like, here it is, you know, but there are these moments that are explicitly transphobic, and it's like, sure. Okay. I think I look at it as it's important to see the impact it had on horror. It is a good film. Mm-hmm. I just know that we can do better now. And right. I make it a part of the work that I do now to strive toward making the thing that I haven't seen yet.
Right. And that's a great segue into your short, your most recent short. You did a few while you were at school in Chapman, but this last one stars Alaska Thunderfuck, who most people might know from RuPaul's Drag Race. Mm-hmm. And isn't it true you had Jordy White, a.k.a. Twiggy Ramirez, do the soundtrack?
Yeah, he did our score.
That's crazy. First of all, how did you get in contact with both Alaska and Twiggy?
So I actually pitched a horror video to Adore and through her manager, Adore Delano, who's another drag queen, and she loves horror. Mm-hmm. And we almost I had a really positive exchange with that manager. And while we didn't go forward with the video, I had written the role of Hattie in my film The Quiet Room for Alaska. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, I had designed this creature that to me really was in line with something that Alaska could perform well, but also was different than what I'd seen her do. So, I reached out to her manager again, but it was her music manager, and, who loved the idea and put me in touch with her people, who represent her on the film side. And it kind of went from there. She dug the idea. And we went with it. And also, we had Katya had the same representation, who was available that same weekend. And once I had those two, the rest was kind of history. I you know, kind of pulled people onto the project after that.
Right. And
so Jordy in particular, actually, he's dating Lainey Chantal, or actually married to Lainey Chantal, who did our makeup. And she's a makeup artist from the Face Off TV show. She was a finalist on that. Nice. And she was already on the project and had done the creature design for Alaska's character, and was like, hey, I think Jordy would really love this. Do you mind if I share it with him? And we started talking after that.
That's great. That's perfect. So it was you weren't in the awkward situation of trying to solicit somebody of his stature. In case people don't know, I'm a music head, and I forget a lot of people aren't. Jordy White was the bass player for Nine Inch Nails, Marilyn Manson originally, and also A Perfect Circle. Mm-hmm. So he's a big part of that kind of like industrial goth world. And yeah, and an incredible musician.
Yeah, he is so talented. Recently we screened The Quiet Room at the DGA, and it had such an incredible system that mm-hmm. I could hear things in the music that he had put in there that I wasn't able to hear even in, you know, in previous screenings at other theaters, just because it was so rich with content, so layered, and some of the low end sounds just, I mean, I am stunned by the work that he did for our film.
Could you describe The Quiet Room a little bit for people who might be interested, or just what is it about exactly?
Absolutely. The Quiet Room is a story about a guy named Michael who tries to kill himself, and he doesn't leave a suicide note, which inadvertently triggers an urban legend at the psych ward he wakes up in, where this creature, Hattie, goes after people who don't leave a suicide note. But the trick is, instead of going after them, she actually takes out everybody they connect with one at a time, isolating those people so that she can have them all to herself and keep them ultimately in the quiet room. So it's the story of Michael and how he has to kind of find the will to live so that he can conquer Hattie and keep her from hurting everybody else around him. But there's also the element, like a lot of psych ward horror, which is how much of this is real? Is this in his mind? You know, and it tackles a lot of the tropes that I've seen in mental health, but I tried to take it from a different angle.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'm very interested in seeing it. I know you've been screening it around a little bit here in L.A. Where are you right now with the film as far as, like, are you looking for some sort of, like, bigger distribution? Are you getting it into festivals?
Yeah, so right now we're actually submitting to festivals worldwide. It's been a really fun, exciting process because so far we were selected by Chapman for First Cut, which is their private showcase of the top films that they have from the year, for those who don't know. So we screened in Seattle last weekend, New York the weekend before, and LA. So it's all pretty fresh as far as an audience goes. So we'll be finding out where we'll have our world premiere pretty soon. But that said, it's been a really exciting summer because there's just been a lot of buzz that has taken me into, I don't know how much this, I've been taking a lot of meetings for it.
Sure.
And it's been a really exciting process. So right now I'm writing a feature version and we'll see where the home for that is.
Well, that's great. I mean, I guess be too obvious about too leading with the question, but didn't you intern for a little while with Blumhouse?
Yeah, so Blumhouse is actually a huge reason why some of these doors have been open, because I worked for them for about a year with my internship, and then they held a private screening for me where I got to share the quiet room with my friends and executives there, and yeah, kind of word of mouth kind of spread after that. And I was able to, and through other people, also through the opportunities that have unfolded because of the film school that I attended and just people I've met along the way. But, I was able to get representation, and representation has, really gotten the word out. So yeah, I've been able to meet with a lot of studios at this point, and that's been really exciting. I mean, definitely not something I would have ever thought would happen right away, especially with something that is so explicitly queer. And I've never seen anything like this. I really didn't know that people would be so receptive right away.
Well, you know, coming off of the surprise success, I suppose, or Dark Horse success of Get Out, it seems to me like now is the time for intersectional genre filmmaking. And I think we're going to see more of it, especially off the success of Get Out.
I agree. You know, we were actually on set shooting when Get Out came out. And I remember I was feeling really nervous about that opening weekend because at the time I had been with Blumhouse. And I'm like, man, I know that if this goes well, this could open the door for a lot of people, you know, me included, especially with the type of horror that I'm interested in making. I want, you know, queer identified characters. I want diverse casting. Mm-hmm. Like, those are things that are very important to me. And I was so happy to see the success of Get Out. And I think we all were.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well over halfway through the year. We're closing in at the end of the year. And while I don't know if I would necessarily call it the best film of the year, I think just based on its themes and based on its success, it's kind of has become the film of the year. And of course, in the political climate that we're living in, the movie just, like, it heightens the themes and the emotions of what's going on even more so.
I think we're living in a time where the subgenre that is going to define our generation is the socially aware horror film. It's going to be a social thriller. I mean, so right now, I think Get Out is going to be our Rosemary's Baby. I think that looking back, I really do believe that it's a turning point for the genre.
I agree. Well, cool. Is there any way that people can see the short, like a Vimeo download or anything like that yet? Or are you holding it specifically for your premiere?
I'm holding it for the premiere. Yeah. Once we get, and also just in case, if we end up selling the feature idea, like then that would go with it.
Sure.
But as of right now, we've got the teaser up, which has a scare actually built into the teaser that was just shot for the teaser on set. And so there is a clip that is only available online that isn't even in the film. which is exciting. And we were able to share that. And I think with the success of the rabid Drag Race fan base, I mean, we got between Instagram and YouTube, we had 80,000 hits in the first, 48 hours. That's on incredible. It. So that was pretty wild. It was, it's really cool to be able to share it. And in the meantime, we've been sharing tons of content on our social media just because people want to see, so it's been fun to be able to share, behind the scenes stuff and also stills from the film. So we have all that content out there, that's available across all social media, but, until we have our premiere, there isn't a place to see it, unfortunately, but the premiere should be very soon because we're in that process.
And we'll definitely keep people posted on when that happens, here on the, either on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/JabberPodcast or on our Twitter, at JabberPodcast. Just, keep your eyes peeled for that and we'll post a link, to your next events that are going to be coming up.
That'd be great.
Well, let's get into the show. Let's get into the reviews for this week. Speaking of Blumhouse, the first movie that we're going to be reviewing is a Blumhouse special called Happy Death Day. And I guess some could say it's sort of a throwback to sort of an 80s style slasher, with a twist, with sort of a postmodern twist. People are calling this sort of Scream meets, Groundhog's Day. And that's, fairly apt. The plot is about a girl who wakes up in a strange dorm room and goes about her day. She's kind of put off a lot of people around her. She's not the most, friendly person, I suppose, and she doesn't surround herself with the most enlightening of people. And as she's going through her day, kind of carefree, trying to, work off a hangover, as the night closes, she ends up encountering a slasher killer with a strange baby mask. And, once she is killed, she awakes again in the same dorm room on the same day to relive it over and over again. And one of the reasons I thought, when I saw this trailer, I thought this could be really clever. I think people right now, this was like 3 months ago or something, people right now are maybe not as aware of like all the things you can do with this premise, because you can really play with the idea of outsmarting the slasher. And that's what I was most excited to see how they tackled this here. It's directed by Christopher Landon and written by Scott Lobdell, both of which have quite a few credits in Blumhouse, including the Paranormal Activity movies and Christopher Landon's previous one, which was not through Blumhouse, I don't think, the Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Yeah, that wasn't a Blumhouse film.
Yeah, that was a little bit more sort of a personal project. What did you think of Happy Death Day?
So I loved it. I think Chris Landon's super talented. And I like the elements that he brought to the Paranormal series. I really enjoyed Paranormal 2 and 3, and he was a huge part of those. And Happy Death Day, I think, I went in, and maybe I went in personally with low expectations, and, just because the concept, I've seen a lot of Groundhog's Day style films, and, and so, I was just like, okay, this will be fun. But I thought it was, smarter than I expected. And it was, just a really good time.
What surprised me about it the most is it was funnier than I expected.
I
don't know if this would tip all the way into the horror comedy realm, but there's sure a lot of laughs to be had. And that the sort of the light breeziness of it and the dialogue and sort of the snappy characters and sort of their interactions and sort of just the celebration of like college youth culture as a whole, really reminded me a lot of like watching the first Scream movie, where it's like, I like all these characters. So you've already won me over that far.
Which is crazy because like the characters should be so unlikable in a lot of cases, but you still love them, which is very much like, I see why the comparisons to Scream are there.
Right. Right. And I think that the big challenge, of the film is to do two things. First, to make you hate the main character, who we should name by
Tree.
Tree is the name of the character played by Jessica Roth. You're made to hate her initially, because she's terrible to everybody she's around. And as each time she dies and comes back, she learns more and more about herself. So it's a perfect vehicle for, character growth and a character arc.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that she's, while she does it, she exudes this charm that is so captivating, mm-hmm. even if she's awful. You know, you just want to like
right.
watch every interaction that she has. Like, I honestly wanted more of her, which is, you know, like I wanted the movie to be just, I would love to just have her on a show, you know,
mm-hmm.
just
mm-hmm.
every interaction that she had was worth the time spent.
Israel Broussard kind of plays opposite her as Carter Davis, the boy with whom she awakes in the dorm room. And his role kind of becomes more and more prominent as the movie goes. And I think they have a strong chemistry there. I really sort of liked him. It took me forever, though, to realize that he was the guy from The Bling Ring. And that was the thing that I recognized him from.
Wait, what?
Yeah,
dude, I didn't even realize that.
I was trying to place it the whole movie.
Ah, yes, totally. See, and I spent the whole movie wondering what was going on with his weird sideburn. But, okay, right. That's who. Because it looks... Come on, did you have that moment where you're like, what is that? There's, like, something on his face. I don't know. It, like, goes
I took it as college scruff.
Okay, right. fair. I mean, I did... Listen, I had my bad sideburn phase, too. I get it. But, yeah, he was great.
From a horror movie level, though, where do you think... On a genre level, I suppose, where do you think this movie succeeds?
So I struggle with PG-13 horror because I don't normally dig it. I just want to see more all the time. I think the reason why this succeeds as PG-13 horror is because we get away with being in Tree's POV for the entire film. So every kill, we get to have all the scares of being stalked, but they never really have to show the blood of it.
Right.
And so, you know, in doing that, they get to set up scene after scene of horror comedy delight, you know? So we've got all the jokes leading up to the end of the night where in each night she dies. So I think that it really succeeds in a way that other PG-13 horror doesn't. And for me, I wasn't even thinking about that. And that was the thing I was the most nervous about. I think it has a few more exceptional scares. And then some of the other ones, you know, it's more on the comedy side, mm-hmm. but I think that, you know, definitely that opening scene was very successful, mm-hmm. at least just from a horror standpoint and playing with the tropes. And, you know, I don't know. I'm obviously not going to get into too much of that, but just, you know, every twist and turn was, it felt like I was in the hands of a film that understood the genre it was contributing to.
For sure. Definitely. And there's some like bravura filmmaking here. There's a lot because they get to play in POV so much. And subject to camera work, there's a lot of, you know, fairly long takes, scenes get to breathe out a little bit. And even mm-hmm. when we revisit those scenes, I think, Landon does a really good job at shooting them slightly different or adding in a new element or taking away an element so that the movie doesn't feel repetitive either.
Yes.
Absolutely. Or knowing when to skip something or go further into something.
Yeah. Or even leaning into the joke of what the film is. You know, it's like, the audience I was with, I don't know, did you see it with a good audience, like a good horror audience?
I saw it almost alone because I saw it at 10:45 on a Sunday. So there was like four other people in the theater with me, which is usually how I want to see most movies. But
yeah.
In this case, yeah, it would have been interesting to see like, where the laughs are, where the shocks are, and that kind of stuff.
See, to me, like, this is the perfect film to see with a packed house. Mm-hmm. Because people are just, like, you know, jumping out of their seats at the scares and, like, and rolling with each of the jokes. And even at some points, like, yelling things at the screen. And I'm like, yes, you are my people. Like, this is exactly the way that I needed to see this. So I had a blast. I think that it became really clear that it was a film that worked. Because sometimes things calm down. As, right. you know, you're in an audience like that and, you know, 10, 15 minutes goes by and then it's just, okay, it settles down. Not this film. Like, it was really all the way through, right to the end. And I think that speaks to the quality of the writing, but also just the directing, the uh-huh. pacing. Uh-huh. You know, I feel like, they found the elements that worked and they hung on.
For sure.
Yeah.
And of course the cast is great too. Do you think that also has benefits with the premise of sort of revisiting this moment over and over again, so that it keeps people sort of like re-energizes everybody in the audience every time they know they're they're going to start from the same point again.
What do you mean?
I mean, rather than a regular three-act structure where, I mean, this has, you know, an implied three-act structure, but rather than a regular linear narrative where you're following the same character all the way through to the very end, and that's the definitive end of the movie,
right.
You know, you might have to deal with lulls, or you might have to think, well, at this point in the film, we need to introduce this, or we're going to have to kind of create some sort of end of the second act struggle or conflict of some sort to sort of bring us into the third act. Like, those kind of concerns can sort of be dealt with at least differently or even avoided altogether, because you have these smaller little narratives that you can play around with.
That's very true, but I will say this. As somebody who loves made-for-TV Christmas movies, the Groundhog's Day thing comes up a lot in those. I know this is, like, wild, but I can think of, like, four examples off the top of my head where this happens. Mm-hmm. And so I've actually had I host movie nights at my house at the holidays where we watch them and talk through them and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun. But we do it because they're so bad. Because I think that when you have that repetitive nature of it, you run the risk of just tiring of your main character. Mm-hmm. And I just did not, I think that I just didn't have that problem with Tree. I didn't tire of her ever. But maybe it also speaks to what you were talking about earlier with the growth that we see from the beginning to the end of the film. I mean, each time she does legitimately walk away with something different that shapes her.
I came away from this actually really uplifted. I mean, given the fact that it's a horror film, and that there's she's being stalked by a serial killer through most of the movie. The things that she learns, how she comes to learn it, the sort of greater impact it has on her as a person, and the way that I think the movie sort of subverts this idea of, like, here's the typical girl who would be the first kill of a horror movie, and you're made to hate her, and she's, you know, the ditzy cheerleader or whatever, she's gonna die, and then we'll get to our real character. And here, you get to see the ditzy cheerleader character completely blossom and grow into a full-fledged three-dimensional being. I think it's a very, very smart screenplay on that level, and a really strong performance by Jessica Roth in being able to know exactly how to pitch each moment we're with her.
Right.
Is there anywhere in the film you thought, you mentioned the PG-13 thing, anywhere else you might have thought, like, it could have gone deeper into something, or could have done better?
Well, this is my critique with kind of everything this year, and maybe it's just because I just feel like we're at that place where we need to start asking for more from our films. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, it's in a post, and I know that this is almost at the exact same time as Get Out, but now that we've had Get Out, I think it's time to demand more diversity in the films that we have. And I love this movie. I think it really succeeds, and I think it's well written, it's well directed, the performances are stellar. But it definitely is a film, you know, where most of it is about just whiteness in general. Mm. It does have, and, you know, without spoiling anything, there are, you know, there is a moment of where there is a gay reveal, and that's really exciting. Uh-huh. To see in a mainstream film, and I was just like, all snaps, like, this is awesome, like, yes, like, finally, which is great, because Chris Landon is openly gay,
right?
So it was cool. I'm like, yes, he's got it, it's in his movie. Like, right. You know, and it's also Tree's reaction to it, which is fantastic. So really, really progressive stuff. But I just, you know, I'm like a dog to the bone. Like, I just want more. I get a taste of it, and I'm like, all right, well, give me more now.
Right. You know? You start writing that whole other movie in your head about what's going on with that guy, and what's, you know. Yeah.
Right.
I know what you're saying. I'd say even if the movie isn't explicitly queer in its presentation, or as far as the character stuff goes, or, you know, in a literal way, I think the sensibility very much is. I mean, there's a certain kind of high camp going on with some of the performances, especially earlier on.
Absolutely. And also, Tree is like, I mean, I don't know, she's every character that I feel like my community gravitates towards.
Right.
She's that mean girl. She's that, you know, I've seen her in Heathers. I've seen her time and age. You know what I mean? Like, she's that one. And so I do think that there is definitely that, that going for it, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I had this reaction with It, and it was an unpopular reaction, and I think it's just time to start asking for more. Even though I do, it's definitely worth recognizing this is great, and maybe this movie doesn't need it, you know? Mm-hmm. But looking at, who were the characters of color in this film? I mean, you know.
Right.
Even the answers to that are interesting to look at, you know?
Right, right. If I were to point out anything in the movie I thought could have been maybe a little bit stronger, and in general, I really like it a lot. I think as far as pop horror filmmaking goes, this is about as good as it gets. And it's,
yes, 100%.
The only thing I thought was maybe a little overwritten was the twist, and I won't give it away, but there's sort of you're led to believe a certain thing at one point in the film, and then you learn it's not that thing. And it's not that I didn't see it coming, or that even if I did see it coming, that would necessarily be a problem, because I don't think the movie hinges on a twist either. But I feel like there's a little bit of time wasted on trying to make you believe one thing when it ultimately isn't that important either way.
Mm. Question for you. Did you see the twist coming?
I guess the fun of the movie is at the beginning of the movie when she is tossing off all these people left and right and being super rude. They set it up. They set it up so that you think the suspect could be anybody.
Right.
Very much in sort of a Scream fashion. You're looking at everybody. Where were they during this scene? What's their motivations? All of that thing. And then towards the end of the movie, as she's like crossing it off Kill Bill style, who it definitely isn't. I kind of had it figured out by like two or three characters, and then they lead us into this red herring that I felt wasn't all that super necessary. Okay. But I enjoyed it once we were there. But then once the true reveal was made, then I was like, oh, okay. Well, you could have just done that. But either way,
yeah, I can see that. I can definitely see that perspective. Mm-hmm. I think that I didn't need more just because when you talk about like pop horror filmmaking, that's just kind of the genre it is for me. But that, you know, but also that said, I had spotted the twist. So I think I wasn't really putting too much energy into kind of piecing it together, following their track, which maybe isn't good. Yes. Maybe that's not, you know, because I remember that like when we talk about Scream and comparing it to a film like that, I mean, that was a moment. You know what I mean?
Right.
That was a real twist that nobody saw that coming, you know? Mm-hmm. But for me, this movie still succeeds, whether or not that twist lands for you.
Mm-hmm. What I like about it most is that, and I don't know where I heard this from. It might have been Red Letter Media. I've been watching a lot of their reviews lately. But they said that, you know, X amount of years ago, how whoever knows what video I was watching, but they said there's very few entry-level horror films being made these days. And I think, like, you know, the Blumhouse stuff, they're pretty much specialize in haunted house films is their big thing with the James Wan thrillers and the paranormal movies. And those are fine enough films, and those aren't necessarily, that's not extreme horror, it's not super gory or super disturbing, but it isn't necessarily a genre that's going to be open to a 13-year-old, like a 13-year-old slumber party. Like, there's not a lot of horror films that are being geared toward the 13-year-old slumber party anymore. It's either that's Halloween true. Town for Disney or Insidious, and that's a pretty big gap between both of those. And so I think this film really fills that gap nicely of like the perfect like entry level almost adult horror, but kind of horror training wheels, I guess.
Horror training wheels, I like that. I also am just a fan of slasher films, and I'm waiting for the film that will knock it out of the park, mm-hmm. so that slashers can have their heyday again. Especially because in political climates like the one that we're in, there tends to be a resurgence, particularly of the slasher film. Mm-hmm. So, like a conservative, you know, an overwhelmingly conservative political climate. Sure. So I'm just like, I've got my fingers crossed, especially after this opening weekend just killed. I mean, they made, $26 million in their, or $27 million in the opening weekend. And mm-hmm. to compare that to like, I think, I think Get Out made like 29 and Split made 33 or something like that. Numbers right. that are similar to that. So this could be on track to be another huge Blumhouse hit. And hopefully, like in the past, Blumhouse has made a bunch of, you know, kind of haunted house type films. I'm mm-hmm. hoping that both Get Out and then Happy Death Day will open the door to more diversity and then more slasher films.
Right.
If I'd have my way.
Yeah, no, perfect. I thought I had one more point to make, but I think that's all I got for Happy Death Day. I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I absolutely recommend it.
It's a good time. It's just a really fun movie.
Yeah, for me, it really works.
Oh, because you mentioned slashers, or the futures of slashers. I was going to ask you, had you seen the movie Hush, and what did you think of that?
I have seen Hush. I really liked Hush. Mm-hmm. And actually, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is that Blumhouse Tilt that did that?
I'm not sure. I caught it on Netflix.
I really liked Hush, particularly the first act, mm-hmm. but it became infinitely less scary to me once he removed his mask. Yeah. So, you know, but that said, I still really enjoyed it, and I definitely recommend it. I think it's worth a watch.
Yeah. Let's get into the second film, McGee's The Babysitter. And can you kind of summarize that? What happens in The Babysitter?
Yeah, it's about a kid who is way too, well, thinks he might be too old for a babysitter. I think he's 12. Mm-hmm. And one of his friends encourages him to stay up and see what happens after the babysitter, or puts him to bed. And he stays up and discovers that his babysitter is a Satanist and is completing a ritual in the living room. So it's awesome.
And hijinks ensue, definitely.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of funny. I didn't realize this was a McGee film until the very end when I decided to look it up. And he's one of those directors, you know, you could say alongside Brett Ratner or Michael Bay to a lesser extent, who has a bit of a bad rap, I guess, among sort of cineasts, as being, I guess, sort of schlocky or being, I guess, more about sort of profit-driven stuff. But this kind of reminds me a little bit of that movie Stretch. Did you see that with Patrick Wilson?
I didn't see that. No, but I know what you're talking about.
Right. That wasn't a McGee film. I think that was Joe Carnahan. But they both had this like little, they both, this movie and that movie had this little kind of, I get to make a movie for me and I have to do it with a much smaller budget, but now I kind of get to do whatever I want to do within the means that I can do it, sort of vibe to it.
Yes.
You know, coming off of our discussion of Happy Death Day, I think this is quite the double feature. I mean, I literally watched them on the same day. I came home from Happy Death Day and started this on TV.
Dude, what a great day.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, wow, this fits together perfectly. I could see this double billing over at the New Beverly next year.
Dude, absolutely. Let's make that happen.
I'll have to talk to Tarantino about it.
That's good friend of ours, so it's no big deal.
Right. But yeah, what I really enjoyed about this movie, first of all, what I really enjoyed about this movie is Samantha Weaving as this character B, the babysitter. Put her in every movie.
Everything. It is perfect casting.
Right.
Like, it's just that both her and the, what's his name? The kid, the main character, Cole. Judah Lewis. Mm-hmm. Samara and Judah were, like, their chemistry is stellar. I just, mm-hmm. I loved every, like, I felt like watching them just even before, you know, things get crazy, just watching them in any scene was just, it made me really excited for the movie that was about to unfold.
Right. And it's unfortunate that that the marketing of the movie, you know, I read the little like blurb or the synopsis or whatever before I started watching it. And I wish I hadn't because there's a good like 2/3 of the, or 1/3 of the movie in where they're really kind of built. Like it almost feels like something you could sort of see on like Disney Channel or something like that, you know, plus or minus some dirty, discussions or whatever. But, know, Ken Marino plays a dad, and it's kind of this goofy sort of Home Alone-ish sort of vibe to it. And yes. Then the parents leave, and it you know, you have this sharp turning point when we go into full-on Splatterfest. Again, talking about a lead actress who has to kind of play two very different sides of the same character, Samara Weaving, she does a terrific job at, like, making you fall in love with her almost as much as this kid is. And, you know, credit to McGee for being able to pull that performance through as well. And then, you know, being terrified of her from a certain point on.
The thing that I feel that that both Happy Death Day and the babysitter have in common is that charisma of that lead character. Mm-hmm. Because Tree and Bee, both rhyming, but they're both women who I want to see. Like, mm-hmm. just, I would watch anything that they do. And I think in particularly in the case of the performance that Samara gave, or that McGee got Samara to give, or, you know, it's unpredictable, despite her being a character we should be totally familiar with.
Right.
I was pleasantly surprised all along the way at how it would take a very charismatic actor to pull off what she did and have me be legitimately interested mm-hmm. in what happened after he went to bed.
Right. Well, she's borderline Manic Pixie Dream Girl. Up to a point. Like, she's so perfect and so nice and so encouraging and so cool, that you know, it's almost to the point where it becomes like almost too much, where it's like, okay, this person doesn't exist in real life. She's a fantasy that's been written. And then when the character takes a turn, McGee is like totally, you know, stabbing that cliche with two blades in the head.
Literally. But that's the thing. I mean, about Manic Pixie Dream Girls, it's like, it's always like, what the hell is she doing with this guy? She doesn't give any, you know what I mean? Like, and this movie has a definitive answer. Yeah. You know, somebody this cool has to have a reason.
Right.
You know, not that he doesn't have his own merit, but, you know, we find that as the movie goes along, he really finds out who he is. So, or what he's made of. You know?
Yeah. And one of the things I really liked about Judah's character, Cole, throughout the movie, is that even though he has to now fight her and take her on, he's still using her advice to be able to get through it, because it was important to his character growth.
Because she wasn't, she's not somebody who's just putting on a front. I mean, she is who she is. And that's something that I love about her character, is she's so authentically written that even her advice matters later, because he gets something from her.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't you say that even, I mean, my favorite kind of horror is that kind of film where you get something from the killer. For example, in a slasher film, you know, the final girl is going to take on qualities of the killer so that she can overcome him.
Right.
You know, and I think that this takes some of the best elements of those films and puts it together into a modern day Satanist movie, which I can't believe I'm saying, because, you know, that genre is so done, but here it is.
Yes.
It reminded me of what I love about Jennifer's Body. Just that smart writing, full control of the amount of camp that's happening. And that balance between horror and just like, and the energy of the momentum of moving forward with the comedy.
Right. And to have a lead actress to really get to sink her teeth into, you know, a really vampy sort of character.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, the only things that I would count against this, because again, I thought this was a whole lot of fun, and this really incorporates, I think, the action set pieces that McGee likes to indulge in as well. And it, you know, it's very contained. It's sort of in one house and one yard, and I like any movie that can do that successfully. The only thing, the other Satanists in the coven, these kind of high school jocks and stuff.
Yes.
I don't think they're quite as well written, and in the place of character development, we have some kind of dated and annoying stereotypes. going on throughout, specifically with an African-American character. Then we have one girl who's just talking about her boob the entire movie. And I felt like both of those, like, as funny and as clever as Bea and Judah are, and even, like, the little neighbor girl across the street, you know, very well-rounded characters, I don't know why these other ones didn't have that same kind of detail.
That's a really good question. Yeah, because I think that there are moments of self-awareness that really pull those characters out of the tropes that they're stuck into, just because I feel like the film knows that they're there. But not for every character. I mean, there's the moment that that Max, the jock, there's that the kid just, or, you know, Cole looks at him and says, "Why isn't your shirt on?" And then they're just like, "Of course his shirt is on. Look at him." You know, right. And it's like, right. All right, that's great. Like, a moment like that works for me. And then all of a sudden, I'm here for Max. Everything and every scene he's here for. I get it. But I think that you're right with Allison. That's the cheerleader.
Yeah, she Bella just, Thorne.
She just, to me, she never rose above the stereotype that she had been written as. Right. That character did have some funny dialogue, but it was completely predictable. And all the way down to sexy moment, and just there are things that that never really were able to break free of I think that the trope that they lean too much on.
Right. Well, I feel like they were felt really strong about certain characters, and they had a whole like arc with them. But then with some of these other ones, they just kind of plug in cheap laughs just to keep them doing something in the movie.
Yeah, like Sonya.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, that one, I was just like, oh, come on. I would love anything from her. Because here we've got, like, you know, she's Asian and she's cast in this role as the sexiest one. Right. You know, and I'm like, hell yes. Thank you. But then she doesn't have any... I mean, I can't think of any memorable dialogue she had the entire film.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Where some of the meatier stuff got given to peripheral characters.
Right. Now, I think one of the better horror moments that's, like, genuinely kind of scary, like a good horror set piece, is with that character when underneath the crawl space of the house. That Absolutely. Stuff plays really well just on a visceral horror level. But, yeah, I would have wanted a little bit more from her personality-wise.
Yeah. I do. The thing that this movie did well, though, when Bea shows up for the first time, the first scare, I jumped. And she is a beautiful blonde woman, and I'm jumping out of my seat. Like, I don't know. And so that's the skill of the director, which is, you know, shocking or not, you know, he really pulled off that initial scare. So I think that something done well is, despite these characters being who they are, still, you know, Bea manages to be menacing. And I would say Max manages to be menacing. Mm-hmm. In these moments of really, you know, of horror.
But then there's that great scene where Max, as he's pursuing his victim in Cole, he, like, encourages him to, like, confront a bully out of, you know, for a moment. And like, really wants him to succeed in that before he kills him, of course. But,
coming-of-age film. Which is, like, I mean, it's completely about growing up, you know? Which is wonderful, and also, I don't know, I feel like in the context of a horror film, a really nice surprise.
Right, yeah. This is written by Brian Duffield, and it has that kind of, I don't know if it is or not, but it has that kind of blacklisty feel to the screenplay.
Like, well, yeah, it was on the blacklist in 2014 as one. This is how I kind of heard about it from a friend at Blumhouse, because he had read the script a while back and said it was really good. He's like, "This is coming out tomorrow. You've got to see it." And and then I watched it. It was amazing. But yeah, it was on the blacklist a few years back.
There you go. Yeah. In case people don't know, the blacklist is sort of Hollywood lingo for the screenplays that everyone thinks is brilliant, but they think nobody's going to make.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, like with this film or that Mel Gibson Beaver movie, they do get made. You know, I was surprised by this. I was surprised again by how much fun it was. And both Happy Death Day and this movie, after a summer, you know, coming off of a summer of almost 3 hour long blockbusters, even the Blade Runner movie, which I liked, but was like nearly 3 hours long. I like economic storytelling. Get me in and get me out in 90 minutes.
Yes, totally. It's like whenever I talk about it and people are like, "So you wanted it to be longer?" And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. You know, there is something to be said about knowing how to get your story told in that amount of time. Mm-hmm. And they really pulled it off.
Yes, in both cases. And you had clear character arcs and interesting ways you could go. And I was never like looking down like, all right, get on with it already.
Yeah.
And they move at a clip as well.
Something I'd say for this film as well as the last one, but maybe it's more stronger for me than it is you. I feel like they both had endings that were very satisfying to me. I really loved the way The Babysitter ended. As soon as I finished it, I'm like, I could watch this again right mm-hmm. now.
Well, yeah, no, I agree. I think it's such a strong arc with those two characters, and where they start and where they end is so important to the growth of both of them, really. It's just really cleverly written and really well acted in that way. And I hope we see more Samara Weaving. I really do, because I think, you know, she has that kind of what's her face from Wolf of Wall Street and Suicide Squad?
I know who you're talking about, but I not
think it's about blanking her. On me right now. Yeah, as I wanted to make the comparison.
But literally everybody listening right now is like, duh, you
screaming
guys.
Screaming at their computer, at their phone. Yeah, she has that kind of vibe. And I think there's a certain kind of natural charisma there. And she sort of has that, even like an Amanda Peet, like sort of one of the boys kind of quality to her. Yeah. I think she could be really strong in comedy as well, like straight comedy.
Yeah. I need to see her in something else, like immediately.
Agreed.
I mean, really. And it's the way I felt. And I brought up Jennifer's Body, and I know that people are on very polarized on that, but I think it is 100% the best performance of her career. I can't even think it's because she did generic babe parts for Transformers and like, you know, it was like.
Right.
Yeah, but it was a career-changing move, and I feel like this is that.
Megan Fox.
It just really is. Megan Fox, thank you.
And Margot Robbie was who I was thinking of earlier.
Fantastic. Yeah. but where it's like, it would be easy to dismiss, dismiss her as just being another beautiful, you know, kind of fill-in mm-hmm. pretty girl. But she has some acting chops, for sure.
Mm-hmm. And comedic talent, which isn't easy. I think there's a lot of people you see in, especially television, if you want to talk about something like Modern Family or like just your name a sitcom, throw a rock and hit a sitcom. There's a lot of people you see in them who are not necessarily comedically talented. They're just good looking.
Right.
And there's more to it than like, you know, comedic timing and being able to do something with a look or a flinch or something like that, that I think that this actress has in spades.
Mm, I agree.
So yeah, we both recommend The Babysitter on Netflix, direct to Netflix.
Direct to Netflix. That's the first direct to Netflix. I mean, they've been really slaying with horror because Hush also direct to Netflix? And then of course Creep.
Right. Yeah. Which I haven't caught up with. I need to see that one.
You do.
But in, in general, you know, Netflix is kind of becoming a bigger and bigger sort of mini studio, to the chagrin of a lot of the mainstream Hollywood elites, and to the companies that own the theaters. They're not a big fan. Like, there's that whole story about the Cannes Film Festival when something from Netflix premiered there and it got booed just for being on Netflix.
Yeah. But here's the thing about horror. It succeeds on such a small budget mm-hmm. that it's exciting to see quality content make its way through to a venue like Netflix. Because traditionally, if you look at like maybe Redbox listings for the last decade, they're terrible, you know?
Right.
Or we have even before that, the straight to video horror film just was a really different beast than anything that was theatrical release. So it wasn't until, you know, maybe like in the 1980s when anything, 1981 and on, mm-hmm. when, you know, you have a killer in a mask, it's greenlit. You know, on this low budget, I feel like we're finally returning to high quality, low budget horror. And it's perfect for something like Netflix.
Right. Yeah. And that might have something to do with the fact that we have these filmmakers like yourself who are emerging at the time that filmmaking is becoming cheaper and more accessible, with digital cameras and digital sound recording. And, you know, this is what I hoped would come out of that is sort of this freedom to create and this freedom to experiment.
I think that as long as we are, our technology is getting better, but as long as we demand better filmmaking, if we demand more inclusive storytelling and, you know, money is going to higher quality content in the, like, the box office results, like something like Get Out can make $100 million. You know what I mean? Like, or I think now at this point worldwide, it's made way beyond that.
Right.
But it just goes to show the people in charge of making these things that we can do it.
Agreed. My only fear of the newer way of making films on digital that's cheaper than the traditional ways of celluloid, my only fear there is now that there's less of a hurdle cost-wise and you know, learning curve and that kind of stuff, is that things will just kind of get content-y, where it's not doesn't super matter what it is as long as you can produce it cheaply and fast and get it up as fast as possible. And in the case of, like, something like the Netflix original film Death Note, the American remake that Adam Wingard did, a usually talented director, that movie felt really content-y to me. And there, when I first started The Babysitter, I was a little worried that that's what was happening, and then the movie took a huge turn and I realized what it was actually doing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I hope that the digital revolution, or whatever you want to call it, doesn't lead into that.
I hope not either.
That film is still film, even if just philosophically.
Yes, absolutely. And I just think, and again, I mean, I'm only speaking to horror because that's where my heart is. But,
sure,
you know, with such a long history of doing, horror's been doing this forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of like, I think that, and that's why the Blumhouse model works so well. Making these cheap films and just seeing what sticks. But I do think that as things become more accessible, it helps the good content flow to the top.
Right. And it always will. Even if you have a sea of, you know, whatever, there's the movies that people are going to remember 5 years later are going to be the ones that rose to the top or were part of that moment.
Right.
Well, great. It was great talking about these movies with you.
Dude, I loved it. Thanks for thanks for having me be part of it.
Totally. You're a perfect guest for this week and for our Halloween month. Before I let you go and before I rattle off all of the plugs for our podcast, where can people find you? Where can people follow you?
I'm at Sam Weinman on Twitter. I'm at Sam Weinman on Instagram. You can find out everything about The Quiet Room on thequietroomfilm.com. And you can also find The Quiet Room on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We're everywhere. Grindr. Okay, maybe not Grindr. You can find me on Grindr. But yeah, that's about it.
Great. And you can follow the show at Jabber Podcast, as I stated earlier. If you have any opinions about anything we talked about today, you can email us at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find me individually at BC Cassidy, BCCASSIDY on Twitter. Follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. You can find my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at salifworkreviews.blogspot.com. And Keith has a bunch of stuff, but I'm not going to mention it because he's not here and I don't remember it. But if you're super interested in that, look up Keith Foster Kid on Twitter. I'm sure he'll post his stuff there. We have friends who also do podcasts, which you should be listening to, including Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, and Denise at her solo podcast, The Mascot Diaries, Bill and Brian at The Great Albums Podcast, Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics, and Patrick and his friend Dennis at Almost Educational. And I think that's it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Talk to you later.
Happy Halloween.